Hey, everyone. So this is Ruben Stan, yeah? And just to say a little bit more about why you did research for thing as it depended originated, what the purpose of it is in the Dhamma. We've already seen one purpose, and that is to show us how suffering arises in the world, the root cause of suffering, if you like it. So in one way, avijja, or ignorance, is the root cause. Of course, in the end, there is no root cause, because avijja itself is caused by other things. Avijja, we shall see that in a second, is caused by the hindrances of the mind, the defilements of the mind. Those defilements are again caused by improper attention, all of these kind of things. We can always go back. Yeah. There is another root cause, which is beyond ignorance, beyond avijja, which we'll have a look at later on to kind of take us even further back to get even more of an overview of what's going on. And ultimately, it can go on forever because there's just more cause and conditions going on there. So the main point is to show how suffering arises out of delusion, ignorance, misunderstanding, and wrong ideas of the world. And it shows that via craving, because craving is the main thing that attaches us to the world, the factor that binds you to existence, always propelling you forward, and also via the idea of rebirth. Rebirth is part and parcel of dependent origination, so it's this whole process which includes rebirth. And there's one more thing as well that dependent origination shows, that it is famous for, that is that this process is an empty process. There's no self is required in this. It's just one condition, one phenomenon leading to another one through a series of links, one after the other. And there's no essential me, there's no soul, there's no I, there's no inherent essence going through this. It's an empty process. And this is kind of one of the most important things. And one of the suttas that I have here is called the Kacchanagopa Sutta, a very famous sutta. I'm not going to read it out because I think it's taking things maybe a bit too far. And I would rather focus on other things that are a little bit more practical than getting into things that are... It's nice, but it's a little bit more philosophical perhaps. So I'm going to leave that out. But this sutta is precisely about how dependent origination is the middle way between eternalism. Eternalism is the idea that there is a soul, that there is a permanent essence that carries on. And annihilationism is the idea, the kind of modern idea that when you die, everything is finished. Yeah, everything just disappears, you're gone, and it's all over. That's the idea of annihilationism. Things kind of come, just cease, and you disappear. And Buddhism had this middle way. Yeah? Annihilationism and eternalism is that kind of the views you always hear about in the world. Almost all religions, they have an idea of eternalism. Whereas more a modern idea, the kind of, you know, the kind of favored by many modern people, actually is not even that modern. It goes back to the time of the Buddha. Yeah, the idea of annihilationism, almost, that's what we find almost everywhere now. It's only really Buddhism that has this strange middle way where things don't really exist. But it's not that they don't exist either. They exist through causes and conditions. Yeah, we all exist in a certain way. We just don't exist in an absolute sense, in the sense of having something permanent inside of us. But you exist in the sense that you feel things, you experience things. In that sense, we certainly do exist. This is that middle way of Buddhism. And it's called paticca samuppada, dependent origination. So that is that. I hope you hope it makes sense. I hope you're okay with it. Otherwise, there's always be chances to ask questions later on. And then what I want to do now is to move on to the third noble truth, because this retreat is coming to an end so quickly. We barely started this one. We're already at this is how this retreat, what they feel like. So fast. And it doesn't matter how long you make the retreat, even if you go on for 10 days, still it feels like you just started when you come to the end. It's like life, you come to the end of your life, if you've barely started, you're already dying. It's how things are. Anyway, so the third noble truth. And this is back to the very first sutta, the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. This is how it goes. Now this is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. is the fading away and cessation of that very same craving, with nothing left over, giving it away, letting it go, releasing it and not adhering to it. And the very same suffering, the very same craving, and that craving we saw before is the craving that leads to rebirth, specifically defined as such in the previous noble truth. So this noble truth also speaks of the rebirth craving, and specifically it is the craving for sensual pleasures, for existence, or for the end of existence. And these are the kind of big problematic ones that we're trying to kind of overcome. Other cravings are kind of minor. This is what we are focusing on. So if you take away the cause, of suffering, suffering ceases. It's obvious. So you want to remove the cause, then obviously the result also has to cease. Just like in medical science, if you have some kind of virus, if you get rid of the virus, you're okay. The cause of the illness is gone, so now you're suddenly free of illness again. So this is what is happening here. This is what it shows you. So how does this work in practice? How does this work in dependent origination? Dependent origination comes in two versions. One is dependent origination, when everything comes into existence. The other one is called dependent cessation, when everything ceases according to the same sequence of things. So if you make an end of avijja at the very beginning, if avijja, it says here, fades away and ceases with nothing left over, then that is the cause for the next factor to cease. Yeah? If there's no delusion, if there's all this insight and clarity, then sankharas come to an end. The choices, you stop choosing in the world. You're no longer interested in searching for happiness in the world. And the sankharas is consciousness. Is no longer, consciousness is still there, yeah? But it's no longer trapped by sankhara. It is free. It is no longer pointing to a particular realm. No longer attaching to a particular level or realm. It's like free from this whole idea of going up and down, belonging to a certain level or quality. And because of that, when you come to the end of your life, because consciousness is no longer connected to any particular realm, it stops right there. Because it stops right there, there is no rebirth. This is how it works according to dependent cessation. So if you have no avidya, what it means is that you're no longer searching for happiness in the world because you know the world is problematic. You are no longer interested in creating things because that you know that creative activity, that doing activity itself is painful. So because you know doing is painful, all you want to do is want to be peaceful all the time. Sabbe sankhara samatha. Means the calming of all sankharas, the calming of the second link of dependent origination, which is sankhara. You're not really interested in that. When you go, you sit down, you close your eyes, you just want to be peaceful. That's why if you're arahant, you bam, you go into jhana straight away. There's nothing to hinder you, because you're not interested in doing. You can calm down, poof, like that, bing, bring jhana. That's kind of the arahant way to see. Many advantages of being arahant, that's one of them. And then this is how the delusion stops the sankharas, yeah? Because you don't want to act, you don't want to do, you don't want to create happiness in that world. And then the consciousness is not affected, as I said. And the whole thing ceases all the way up to self-suffering, stage by stage. And of course, the point here is that if you reduce delusion, avijja, a little bit, then this works itself through the process, and you reduce suffering a little bit. If you reduce avijja, delusion more, you have even less suffering, and all the way until you have the full insight, and then everything ceases as a consequence. So what we need to look at now is how that process of eliminating avijja, eliminating delusion, ignorance, how that happens. Yeah? Because this is really the critical question. How do we get rid of avijja? And we have already talked about it a little bit, but now I want to look at it in a stepwise fashion. And this is one of my, obviously the Noble Eightfold Path is one way of looking at this, because that's the last factor of this Four Noble Truths. But there's another way I want to look at first of all, which ties in with dependent origination. So this is the next sutta I want to look at here. And I think I did it here before, a couple of years ago, but it's a nice sutta, so it's worthwhile doing again. So, we forgot to put page numbers in here, it's a bit unfortunate, but if we did, there's a sutta on the bottom of the page, you have ignorance, and it starts on the next page after that. If you can find that one, you'll have the right one there. Okay. So, this sutta starts off as we have seen before, the Buddha speaking, mendicants. It is said that no first point of ignorance is evident, before which there was no ignorance, and afterwards it came to be. And yet, it is evident that there is a specific condition for ignorance. Ignorance here in Avijja is the same word as the beginning of dependent origination. Yeah? Same thing with talking about it. So there is a specific condition for ignorance, which means that there is a cause, and as soon as there is a cause, there is a way of eliminating it. Yeah? And that cause, it says here, it says that ignorance is fueled by something. It is not unfueled. And what is the fuel for ignorance? You should say the five hindrances. Yeah, fuel, the Pali word is ahara. Ahara, fuel means something which makes something grow. Yeah, if you want to, if you put fuel, you put water, you put whatever, when you add ahara, when you add nutrients to something, nutrient is another word, when you add nutrient to a plant, the plant grows. So by adding more to the five hindrances, you're increasing avijja, increasing delusion. This is how delusion becomes worse. That's already a very useful point. Yeah? The more there is of the five hindrances, does anyone know what the five hindrances are? Anyone not know? Actually, maybe that's a better question. Not sure? Okay. Five hindrances. It's good to be honest, otherwise you don't learn anything. Yeah? Otherwise it's a thing. Delusion becomes even worse. The five hindrances are the five main obstacles that I talked about in Buddhism to meditation practice specifically. And these are sensual desire. Any sensual desire means any desire in the five senses, any enjoyment in the five senses. Ill will, the kind of almost the opposite of desire, when you get angry with the world, or angry especially with people. Then there is the tiredness and lethargy, and tiredness feeling kind of not having a right mind. Then there is restlessness and remorse, where your mind is agitated, you can't become peaceful. And then there is doubt, is the last one. These are the five hindrances. And you can see why they are hindrances, because they are obviously things that disturb the mind, don't make the mind peaceful, and it makes it hard to gain any kind of stability, etc. So these are the few. The more you have of these, the more ignorance you have, the more delusion you have, the more kind of way off track you are. And not only that, but nutriment or fuel, as it says here, especially if you use the word nutriment, which I think is preferable in this case. I always like to criticize my friends, like Adam Siddhartha, he's his translation. It's always that. Please don't tell him, but I'm just messing around a bit. But the point is that what is interesting about translation, that things can be translated in different ways. And when you give something a different angle, it often brings out another aspect of the Pali. It's the thing about languages, as you would know, and most of you here are bilingual anyway, if you are bilingual, you know that in one, there's often not one word in one language that's exactly the same as the word in another language. There's not an exact overlapping of words from one language to another one. So for that reason, often it's impossible to find a precise word which is exactly right. That's why it can be useful to translate in different ways, to bring out different aspects. So the idea of nutriment is the idea that if you take away the nutriment, something dies. Take away the nutriment from a plant or from a human being, you die. You can't live without nutriment. And exactly the same thing is also happening here. You take away the nutriment. treatment for avijja and delusion, and delusion dies. It doesn't have that support anymore, doesn't have the nourishment, doesn't have the fuel. Yeah, this tells you already so much about what the practice is about. We have to remove these five hindrances. Yeah? And of these five hindrances, the two first ones are by far the most important ones. The sexual desire and ill will, because the last three, they are very much a byproduct of the first two. So focus on the first two ones. And if you read the suttas, you will see that again and again the Buddha talks about ways and means of overcoming these first two defilements. This is so important. And this, I'm going to focus on this tomorrow morning when we have the last talk. It's going to be more about the practice of things. And then we have kind of covered quite a lot. And so then it's going to be more kind of directly about the fact. Everything is about fact, but that's more kind of directly. So because of that, this is so important that as long as you are able to reduce those desires and reduce that ill will, you will have more clarity. You will have less delusion in your mind, and you will have much greater ability to live well and do all the right things, and eventually eliminate the whole problem. So that's it. That's what it's about. So the question then becomes: how do we eliminate these five hindrances? This is really the big question here. So to find out now, instead of going back in this particular sequence, I'm going to skip a few paragraphs down. And if you go down four paragraphs, we come to the opposite. So this is what we're having now was the fuel for ignorance. Yeah, now we're going to look at the fuel for the opposite of ignorance. The opposite of ignorance is knowledge, understanding, and freedom. So this is what the Buddha has to say about this. This is a very beautiful expression of how liberation is arrived at according to the suttas. I said that knowledge and freedom are fueled by something, are nourished by something. They are not without nourishment or nutriment. What is the nourishment for knowledge and freedom? Knowledge and freedom is the opposite of ignorance and delusion. Yeah? It is clarity. It is liberation from dukkha, oppression, from suffering, all the problems of the world. This is the one thing that is really worthwhile on this path. What is it? It is the seven awakening factors. We talked briefly about the awakening factors yesterday, very, very briefly. I may talk about it a bit more tonight if you wish, just to remind you of what they are, but actually I can do it now because they're here anyway. These awakening factors, they are all about samadhi, all about deep meditation. Yeah? So what this is saying is that if you want to stop delusion, there's only one way of doing that. It's deep meditation. Just like we saw before. Just like the end point of the Noble Eightfold Path is the samadhi, the jhana, in the same way here, you see exactly the same thing. So these seven awakening factors, what are they? Well, they're called sampurjangas in Pali, these awakening factors. And the sampurjangas, sampurjanga means seven. The first one is sati sampurjanga. Sati is mindfulness, yeah? So it starts off with mindfulness. That's already quite interesting. I will show you why that is so in a second. Then we have the Dhamma Vichaya Sampurjanga. Dhamma Vichaya means investigation of Dhamma. Dhamma means like phenomena. Yeah? It can be phenomena in a very broad sense, but mostly it refers to the personal quality that you have, whether you have five hindrances or not, that sort of thing. Yeah? Dhamma Vichaya. Then, this is a sequence which again is causal. One element comes after the previous one, and it arises in a causal sequence. When we have enough sati, we are able to have investigation of dhammas. When we have investigation of dhammas, and you overcome the negative qualities of mind, you gain energy. The virya sampurjanga, which is the third one. Energy of the mind. If you feel right, if you feel energized, this is not the same as putting forth effort. Yeah? This is not mean, doesn't mean you apply yourself. It's a natural, peaceful energy that you have inside. Sometimes you probably notice that sometimes you feel more energetic than other times. Yeah? It's not a restless energy, but a peaceful, powerful energy of the mind. Then from that virya sampurjanga comes the piti sampurjanga. Piti is the joy, yeah? The powerful joy of meditation practice. These are very beautiful things that you will notice that these are similar to almost all why it is that the sequence of meditation is discussed in the sutta is always discussed, pretty much this kind of sequence. I'm going to show you some comparative tables at the very end later on to show you how common this particular sequence is in the sutta. And it's always the same. So much focus on joy, happiness, tranquility, all of these things. It's incredibly attractive. Everything you ever wanted is actually in there now. From the Piti Sampradanga comes the Pasati Sampradanga. Pasati is tranquility. Yeah? When you become incredibly peaceful, all agitation, all restlessness is gone. You become like this rock, solid like a rock. You just sit there, you feel blissing out, you feel incredibly peaceful. These are the two qualities of meditation practice that you see throughout your meditation experience. Two things grow and become stronger and stronger and stronger. The bliss becoming more and more powerful, the tranquility and peace becoming more and more powerful. These two qualities together are what grow as you go deeper in meditation. From the Pasati Sampradanga comes the Samadhi Sampradanga. Yeah? This is what we talk about all the time now. Samadhi, deep meditation experience. The four jhanas, they are the main Samadhi Buddhism on the four jhanas. You see them again and again. And from the Samadhi Sampradanga comes the Upekkha Sampradanga. Upekkha meaning equanimity, evenness of mind, where the mind is completely even. It doesn't allow itself to be disturbed by anything in the whole world. It's a very, very powerful and kind of even mind. Because it is so powerful and so even, it doesn't allow itself to be disturbed by anything. It is the perfect mind for getting deep, in, of deep insight and deep wisdom. Yeah? And this Upekkha Sampradanga is the Upekkha of the fourth jhana, the highest jhana experience that you can have. So this is what this is all about. It's all about samadhi practice. It is that samadhi which gives rise to the knowledge and freedom of the path that we're seeking. It eliminates avijja, because it eliminates avijja, the first factor of dependent origination. It then eliminates all the other factors and dukkha is finished. You're free from dukkha. It's good news, isn't it? Free from dukkha. Yay! Just get much better than that. That's kind of this is the best. So now what we want to do, we want to go back, stage by stage, all the way back to the beginning. And we want to ask, well, what is the fuel or the nutriment for the factors of awakening? I say that the seven awakening factors are fueled by something. They are not unfueled. What is the fuel for the seven awakening factors? You should say the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. You know what that is? The four kinds of mindfulness meditation? Yeah? Some of you are nodding. So, you know what that is then? Satipatthana, maybe? Yeah? Yes. Satipatthana, that's what it is. Yeah. This is his translation for Satipatthana. This is Anna Sudhakar. He does things his way. Everyone has to do things their own way. That's kind of some of the fun of translating. You kind of have. This is one how he translates the four Satipatthanas, the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. And this too is very fascinating because very often in Buddhism, we teach Satipatthana as the, you know, the thing which this is called Vipassana meditation. Do Satipatthana, they say this is equivalent to Vipassana, that leads to awakening there. But here you actually see a much more, you see a more refined way of looking at this. And the refinement here is that actually, no, Satipatthana leads to Samadhi. Samadhi leads to awakening. This is what it's saying here. This is actually something that you find everywhere in the sutras. If you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, the seventh factor is the Sammasati, which is the Satipatthana. Then comes Sammasamadhi, then comes awakening. This is found everywhere. So it is a very important point. Yeah? It is not as if you go straight from Satipatthana to awakening. You always have to go via Samadhi. So what is Satipatthana practice? And this is another very interesting point, because Satipatthana practice is often taught in so many different ways. You go to the Mahasi method, you go to the Goenka method, you go to various other methods, and everyone teaches it slightly differently. But in the suttas, the way the Buddha teaches Satipatthana, there's one way that he says fulfills Satipatthana, mindfulness of breathing. Yeah, it's the only meditation topic you need to do, and that will take you all the way to awakening if you do it fully. fact, it's interesting. This is how the Buddha teaches it. Yeah? So this is why it is so valuable to read the suttas, because we get information, we get understanding, which sometimes is at odds with how often we are taught the Dhamma sometimes. I'm not saying these other methods are wrong, I'm saying this is how the Buddha teaches, and for that reason it is the most powerful method ever. So all you have to do is watch the breath. And that's not all, I shouldn't say all you have to do, because that's just, it's quite challenging to watch the breath fully. But that is the method, that is what you have to do now. That takes you all the way to the jhanas, to the doorstep of the jhanas. And then, after jhana, then awakening happens. This is the right way of thinking about these teachings. I'm telling you these things, not necessarily so much because you're going to do this afternoon. Maybe you will, and that would be wonderful if you did. But the point is just to have a map in your mind, to have some kind of idea, where we're heading, how this works. My idea is always to open the door to the real Dhamma, the real teachings of the Buddha. That is, I feel, my obligation as a monk. Instead of teaching, just teaching my own teachings, most teachers in the world, they kind of talk from their own experience, which is fine. It's a nice thing to do now. But I prefer this idea of teaching from the word of the Buddha, because this is the original teaching. This is what the Buddha himself said, where we should find inspiration in his own teachings. So I feel it's almost my obligation to read these things out. And I try to be honest. I try not to distort things. I'm going to distort things, because it's impossible to get things 100% neutral. This is impossible. And for this reason, it's always very useful to read these things yourself. But I try to be as honest as I can with what is in the suttas. So, mindfulness of breathing, samadhi, then profound wisdom and insight. So what is the cause for satipatthanas, for mindfulness meditation? What is the nutriment for mindfulness meditation? And it says here, I said the four kinds of mindfulness meditation are fueled by something. They are not without nutriment. What is the nutriment for the four kinds of mindfulness meditation? You should say the three kinds of good conduct. Tini sucharitani is the pāmiha. And three kinds of good conduct is just the same thing as the three kinds of morality that we talk about in Buddhism all the time. Morality of body, morality of speech, and morality of the mind. That's all it is. So what this means is that the thing that supports our meditation practice, the one thing that is more important than anything else, is morality. This is the support that makes meditation possible. So if you have any doubts, if we don't understand why your meditation isn't going deeper than it does, well, the place you need to look, most likely, is in your morality, your conduct. Can you purify yourself further? Can you be more patient with people? Have more compassion, even for those people in the world you don't agree with. Even the nasty people in the world. Have understanding, compassion, even better. This is the kind of the critical issue that we need to do, meditation, to come together. It's all about morality. Yeah, this shows you how important this is. It was very interesting. We have every year when we have the rains retreat in Jhana Grove or in Bodhidharma Monastery, we have a lot of people who come and stay at Jhana Grove, for the 3 months of the rains retreat. This year we have maybe 30 people all together or something like that. And one of those people was the founder of the PIF, which is very nice. And one of these people who came to him was a Norwegian fellow who I know a little bit from before. He said to me after the retreat, he said to me, well, I always thought that this was just the way that monks were topping off the lay people, practice morality, and we will do that, we will do kind of the rest of the work to enlightenment, and you guys use practice morality, the kind of way of kind of dismissing the lay people. But it's not, One of the things that you will find is that the teaching you get as lay people is pretty much the same teaching the monastics get. You get to hear everything that's in there, and that's why sometimes it's quite challenging. Nobody's trying to fob anyone off, but everyone is being honest about these things. And so he came to that, but now I realize, having heard of this sutta, I realize actually how incredibly important this whole idea of virtue and morality is. It really is the foundation for the entire path. That was interesting because it shows you how important it is to make this point again and again and again, because people don't realize how significant it is. It is what makes meditation possible. Morality and right view. These two things come together. Right view is the support for morality and meditation, and morality is the main support for meditation itself. So, how then do we purify these three kinds of good conduct? Well, this is the next one on this list. And these are also fueled. What are they fueled by? They are fueled by sense restraint. Yeah, sense restraint means that it is the idea of keeping a pure mind. That is what sense restraint is about. And I have talked about this here before, but it's important here to understand what this actually means, because in the English language the word restraint sounds like you're using a lot of force in your meditation practice, or force in your practice. That is not really what it means. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you have to use a lot of force. What it means is just that you keep your mind in a balanced state. You don't allow it to go into ill will, you don't allow it to go into very strong desires. This is what it really means. And the main tool for doing that is wisdom. Thinking in the right way, reflecting in the right way. I will show you a sutta later on called the two powers, what is called the Patti Sankalpa, the power of reflection. This is the way to overcome any kind of impulsive qualities. So you use wisdom, wisdom power. This was the thing that Adam Brown always taught me when I was a young man. He said, yeah, use wisdom power, not use willpower. I said, yeah, whatever. It's like, you know, it's like you are a bit dismissive of initially, you think, yeah, I know better, that's what you are. You know, you always think you know better until eventually you realize you were wrong all along, your teacher was right. And then especially when you read the sutras, you get that confirmation of what actually is right. And it's wonderful when it happens. You know, it's good to be able to give up your own silly ideas sometimes. It's about using wisdom then. Yeah? Knowing how to look at other people so it doesn't give rise to anger. Seeing them as not having free will to do what is right, but heavily conditioned beings who always do silly things. How can you not forgive people when you look at them like that? I'll come back to this later on. So, what is the fuel for sense restraint? This is the next one. What is the fuel for sense restraint? You should say mindfulness and situational awareness. Situational awareness, it's kind of a strange word. But the idea behind this, and this again is Bhante Sudhanto's translation, the idea behind this is that when you are in different situations in life, you have to have a mindfulness that is appropriate for that situation. Yeah? So the way it is described in the sutta is if you are talking to somebody, you have a mindfulness of what you're doing. Okay, I'm talking. Am I talking? Am I saying the right thing? Am I saying suitable things? Is this going to be helpful for me? Is it going to be helpful for the person I'm talking to? Should I shut up now or should I continue talking? What is the right time to be quiet? When we eat, what is the right amount of food to eat? What is the right kind of food? All of these things, situational awareness, depending on the situation you are in. And the idea is to have awareness that always helps you to move forward on the path. You speak in such a way, you eat in such a way, you act in such a way, you do everything in your life in such a way that is helpful for your practice. This is very difficult to do in lay life sometimes. Sometimes very difficult even to do in monastic life, but even more difficult in lay life where you have to work and all of these things. But it gives you a rough idea of how to think in life, yeah? When, if things are conducive or not to moving forward on the path. So at work, you know, how do you deal with your work? Some of you are doctors and you know, what a wonderful thing it is to be a doctor, because it's almost naturally caring and giving occupation, yeah? I know some doctors probably not all that caring and giving, because sometimes you lose that initial, that early, you know, the early kind of, you know, the idea, wow, it's such a wonderful to be a doctor, and after a while you get kind of cynical by the world, all these kind of things, but potentially. actually, it's a wonderful thing to be a doctor or a nurse or a school teacher, because all of these are services you provide to society. Or a monk, yeah. Great to be a monk or a nun. Good to be a nun as well then. Because you have one of our main things is to provide services. And what a wonderful thing that is. You just have to use that situation in the right way. Use your work in the right way. Even if you work in something which is maybe not as obvious as service, there's always somebody who benefits from what you do. Focus on that. Make it into a spiritual path. Mindfulness and situational awareness. Once you have enough mindfulness, you know what is going on. It means that you know when you are speaking in the right way, when you're acting in the right way, even if you are thinking in the right way. It takes quite a lot of mindfulness to have that awareness of what you're thinking all the time. Yeah? You don't get into bad thoughts. But eventually you get there as well. That is when sense restraint becomes possible. This is why this is the cause for sense restraint. Because you have to have that awareness of what is going on before sense restraint can happen. So what is the cause or the specific condition for mindfulness and situational awareness? And it should be said, proper attention. Proper attention here is yoniso manasikara, very kind of famous word in Pali, and it means that we pay proper attention to what is going on. You look at things in the right way. Yeah, you look at things with wisdom. You look at things with an eye to improving yourself, to going in the right direction. Proper attention is that when you look at someone else, so either you see them with eyes of kindness or with eyes of compassion. That's kind of proper attention. If you see someone else with a mind of fault-finding, it's called improper attention. Ayoniso manasikara. This is really all it is. You attend to some attention, it does what we do all the time. It's either good or it's bad, depending on whether it leads to defilements or it leads to purity. It's really as simple as that. But then comes the interesting ones. What is the fuel for proper attention? And it says here, hey, Sadha in Pali. Faith is the cause for proper attention. And this is fascinating. Why is this fascinating? Well, it's fascinating because you would think that maybe proper attention comes from wisdom. Yeah, if you're wise, then you attend properly. How can it come from faith? And the answer is that when we start out on the Buddhist path, we don't really know what is right and what is wrong. We haven't got that much wisdom in the beginning. So we have to rely on someone else. We have to rely on the Buddha. The Buddha will tell us. Yeah, he said, this is the right way to attend. If you attend it this way, then you will be heading in the right direction. And then this way, you're going to go in the wrong direction. Use yoniso manasikara, not ayoniso manasikara. So confidence in the Buddha's teaching is the initial point that allows us to attend wisely. So what does the Buddha say? I'll just give you an example. And what the Buddha says is that if you look at the Patthika Nibbitta is what Patthika is like resistance. Yeah? So if you look at something that you find difficult to look at, something inside of you is resisting that, something which is unpleasant. If you look at something, especially in another person which is unpleasant, it will give rise to ill will eventually. You see some quality you don't like, and eventually you don't want to have anything to do with that person. As the Patthika Nibbitta, you have looking at the person in the wrong way with ayoniso manasikara. The Buddha says this in the suttas. So instead of giving attention to the Patthika Nibbitta, you give rise to the Subha Nibbitta. Subha means the beautiful. When we look at the beautiful, it doesn't mean that we look at the beautiful in an ordinary way. Yeah, or we see a beautiful person, or we see a beautiful think in the world that we really like. That's not what it means. It means that we look at the beautiful qualities of that person. We look at the qualities of the heart. We look at the kindness of that person. That's what it means. And when you look at the beautiful qualities, it doesn't lead to desire. It leads to a pure mind. So even beauty, sometimes it's right to look for beauty. We just have to know what kind of beauty to look for. Look for the beauty of the heart, not the superficial, external beauty, but the beauty within. That is what you want to look at. And when you see beautiful qualities in people, you have mental kindness towards them. Yeah, you feel naturally kind towards someone when you see their good qualities. So this is how the Buddha talks about these things. He said these things specifically in the sutta. Yeah, it's all there. You just have to read it. And then when you get faith in that, you act accordingly. When you act accordingly, you actually become more pure as a person. And this process starts to happen as a consequence. So faith, and of course that faith, as I mentioned before, is very close to wisdom. Yeah, wisdom in Buddhism, wisdom and faith, wisdom and confidence are two sides of the same coin. So as you practice in this way, that faith gradually turns into wisdom. You see how it works. You see that this is real. Yeah, and as it works, you think, wow, now I can see it for myself. And then faith becomes even stronger because you see it for yourself. Wisdom and faith growing in tandem, growing together in this one. So how do we get faith and confidence? Yeah, this is the next one. It's kind of exciting, isn't it? Here we get going back and back to the very beginning. So some of you might know what the beginning is already, but if not, you're probably very excited by that. We'll see where this all goes. So 1.11 appears nice to faith, and it's not very surprising, it is listening to the true teaching, the true Dhamma. If you get to hear really good spiritual teachings, it tends to awaken something inside of you. You recognize that this is good. You think, wow, this is really powerful. There's something really powerful going on here. But this is the thing about the word of the Buddha. It has this, if you are ready, then you will feel, you will find these teachings incredibly attractive, and you will be drawn towards Buddhism as a consequence. Something very special is this feeling that there's some really powerful spiritual genius behind these teachings, because they are just so coherent, so powerful, so sensible. They relate to how we all experience the world, and that is why they are so meaningful for us. So how do you get to hear these beautiful teachings? And the Buddha says it is by hanging out, by associating with superior people, or with good people, it says here. Associating with good people. I prefer hanging out, a bit more modern. Hanging out with superior people. That is where it comes down to. So, how do you hang out with superior people? These are called the sakunis, good people is a bit too weak. It really means not just good, but it means people who have real insight into this teaching. Sakunis and Pali. It's a synonym for Arya, for noble ones. How do you hang out with noble ones? Well, the answer to that is that you don't really know who is a noble person in this world. Yeah, it's very, very hard to pinpoint. Sometimes you think, oh, I know who is a noble one. Ajahn Brahm is a noble one. Are you sure? I think so too, but sometimes I say, maybe I'm wrong. Yeah, who knows? Actually, I'm pretty sure Ajahn Brahm is one of those in the world. I've been with him for 25 years and I'm still not disillusioned by Ajahn Brahm. There must be something powerful going on there. But still, we cannot be 100% sure. Right? It's just a guesstimate. Yeah, maybe he is. What about some of his other teachers in the world? Like Ajahn Kanha in Thailand, when you meet him, you feel, oh yeah, he might be an Arahant, yeah, or at least a noble one. But can you know him? It's very hard to know, especially someone you don't know so well. What about all these other teachers that we hear about? Everyone says, yeah, he's an Arahant. Be very careful. When everyone says he's an Arahant, usually there's reasons for doubt. Yeah? Because everyone just doesn't know. Everyone is deluded. Everyone is a bit clueless. When everyone says one thing, think, okay, I'm going to reserve my judgment and I'm going to see it for myself. It's good to be a bit skeptical. Good not to be too easily drawn in by these things. So there's only one source at the end of the day. Yeah, one place you should always come back to, and that is the sutras. So there's only one saparisa, one area you can be sure about, that is the Buddha. Because if the Buddha is not awakened, if the Buddha doesn't know what we're talking about, then there's no point in being a Buddhist in the first place. So we have to assume that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, and it kind of comes out in the sutras. This is the power of coming back to these words again and again and again. So hang out with the Buddha. And this is kind of what I like to do on these retreats. That's why I like to read the suttas, because it is a bit like hanging out with the Buddha, associating with the Buddha. Yeah? And you may think this is fanciful because the Buddha passed away 2,500 years ago. How can you hang out with the Buddha? But one of the things about the Buddha is that we realize that these teachings were going to carry on in society for a long time in the future. That's why his first teaching is called the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana Sutta. Dhamma is the teaching of the Buddha. Chakka is the wheel. Pavattana means to set it going, make it roll. You're rolling on the wheel of the Dhamma. So the Buddha knew that when he started this teaching would roll out into the world. And it would roll from one century to the next one, from one millennium to the next millennium, from one culture to the next one. And now they are spread out all over the world. People all around the world are benefiting from these teachings. So because he knew that, he phrased his teachings in a very universal way. And that is why we can read them in this very day and we can understand what is going on. There's very little there that is culturally specific. It all has to do with the mind. It has to do with fundamental, basic things that are true for everyone. He doesn't talk about Indian culture so much. Occasionally, you get a little bit of glimpse of Indian culture, but not very much. That's kind of interesting too, but it's not really important. Yeah? And so when the Buddha was giving these teachings 2,500 years ago, he was thinking of us. Yeah, he was thinking of us. So we, in a very real sense, we are his disciples. The Buddha thought in Kaduri Center 2,500 years ago from now. Well, he wasn't that specific, maybe, but he knew roughly what was going to happen in the future. And so when you read the suttas, remember that the Buddha is actually talking to you. He's talking to me, he's talking to each one of us. This is not some kind of ancient text that has no relevance to you. It's only relevant to the monks of that 2,500 years ago. The Buddha was thinking about all these future generations. So when you're reading this, he's thinking about you. And it makes it so much more powerful when you think like that. It means that you're taking the Buddha to be your teacher in a much more direct and immediate sense. It makes your hair stand on end, at least if you have a bit of hair. So because you feel, wow, this is the Buddha talking to me. And then it starts, then you are really taking the Buddha as your teacher when you do that. This is, in a sense, how to inspire yourself a little bit, to remember these things. This is not just fanciful. I'm saying this because this is essentially the truth. And because it is the truth, that is why it is powerful. So take the Buddha as that source, yeah? This is the Saporisa at the beginning here. It doesn't mean you should just read the word of the Buddha, because sometimes you can go astray if you try to do it only by yourself. So also, listen to people who you feel have some understanding of this word, and then use your own experience and kind of mix it all together quite nicely. But ultimately, come back to this and the source of everything else. And to understand why this is so important, this is one of the similes that I always like to bring out at this particular point. Why it is so important to have this Saporisa, the Kalyanamitta. The Buddha is also the Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta is a good friend, a good spiritual friend. This is the very root here, at the very beginning of all of this. Yeah? If you have that Kalyanamitta, then all the other things are nourished, and they happen more or less by default. If you hang out enough with the Buddha, you're going to become enlightened eventually. That's what this is saying. Yeah? That's basically what it's saying. So, why is that the case? And the reason why it is the case is because you are getting brainwashed. Yeah, and this is true. And the thing we think that brainwashing is bad, because usually brainwashing means that someone is going to take you for a ride and they're going to kind of abuse you or whatever. That's normally how we think about it. But the point is that if we are not autonomous, if we are not free to make our own choices, if we are conditioned by society, by past lives, by our upbringing or whatever it is, it means we are already conditioned. We are already brainwashed. Yeah? You have no choice. You have to be brainwashed. So if you're going to be brainwashed anyway, choose the good brainwashing. Yeah? Choose the brainwashing that makes you happy, not the one that makes you miserable and sad. Yeah? This is kind of the trick here. This is the thing. And of course, ideally, brainwashing should clean you out. Yeah, it should really wash your brain properly, so it should get rid of some of those defilements. So real brainwashing is not just that you're led by the nose, but also that you feel pure inside. That is the real brainwashing. So you need that brainwashing, and this is how it's brainwashed. But be brainwashed, be intelligent about it. Reflect how it works, yeah? Reflect that it is right. It should feel good to you, no? If it feels right, if it is intuitively right, and then, oh, it's okay to allow yourself to reframe what you did with it. So, this matters so enormously because the reason is very simple. It's because if there is no self inside of us, if we are always the sum total of the cause and conditions that work on us, it means that we are not autonomous. Everything is working on us all the time. And a nice simile to think about this, which I usually tell in this connection, is it is a bit as if you are a boat on the ocean. But you are a boat on the ocean with no steering mechanism, with no propulsion, no propeller, no engine, nothing like that. You're just a hull, yeah, the empty hull. No sail, no oars, nothing like that. And if you have a hull on the ocean like that, you cannot steer, you can't go anywhere. It means that you're going to be at the mercy of the conditions around you. If the wind comes from the south, then you're going to go to the north. If the wind comes from the west, you're going to go to the east. If the current comes from the west, you're going to go to the east. These, the sum of these cause and conditions, the wind and the current and maybe the sharks or whatever, and if the shark comes and pushes the boat, I don't know, then all of these things together will decide where you are heading. Yeah? So, and if you are going to, if you want to go to Nirvana, which maybe is to the, where is Nirvana? Maybe to the east, to the Buddha, I don't know, whatever. So if you want to go to Nirvana, make sure you get the wind from the west. If Nirvana is in the east, get the westerly wind, otherwise you're not going to go to Nirvana. And the way to do that is to allow yourself to be brainwashed by the good teachings of this world. You could be conditioned in the right way, and when you're conditioned in the right way, you're going to be heading towards happiness. And there's a beautiful simile, which I might as well tell now, because the simile is in this particular sutta, and it shows you how this works. Yeah? And this is kind of a little bit astonishing when you hear this. And this simile is a simile on the rain on the mountaintop. Yeah? And the idea of the rain on the mountaintop, rain is like the beginning of this path. The rain is like listening to the word of the Buddha, hanging out with the Aryans, with the noble ones, as the rain on the mountaintop. Yeah? So when it keeps on raining on that mountaintop, raining and raining and raining, eventually that rain, it forms into little streams. Yeah? A ton of little streams in the beginning. And those streams, they run down the mountainside, forming into larger streams. And eventually those streams, they go into the small lakes. If it keeps on raining, but it has to keep on raining, that's the kind of the critical thing here. Keep on raining, keep on raining. Those little lakes will eventually fill up. If it keeps on raining, those little lakes will overflow. And you will have larger streams going into larger lakes. If it keeps on raining, the rain is a critical thing here. If it keeps on raining, those large lakes will fill up. And eventually those large lakes too will overflow. They will go into the large rivers. Keeps on raining, those large rivers will swell up and become large. And then eventually they will reach the ocean. Yeah? The critical thing here is the rain. The rain is listening to these true teachings. Coming back to these teachings again and again, allowing yourself to be inspired. Allow yourself to feel, wow, there's something really important going on here. The world is a mess. It's a spiritual life that really matters. So you keep the rain coming. And as you do that, this whole process happens. You're listening to the true teachings. You gain faith. You have the yonasavanasikara. You have the satisampajanya, the mindfulness and situational awareness. You have the indriyasambara, the sense restraint. From the sense restraint, from the tinis or chalitani, the three kinds of good conduct, then the meditation comes together, then you get the seven four jhanas, then comes the knowledge and freedom, the vijja, the mukti at the end of the path. The whole thing happening, and all you have to do is allow that rain to continue falling at the mountaintop, continue studying the sutras, allow yourself to be inspired, and eventually you will go there. It may take a while, it may have to rain for a long, long time, but eventually you will get there. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's so powerful. And it's so easy. It sounds almost too easy to be true. But actually, this is how the Buddha teaches this. So come back to these things. You may have heard a beautiful simile that Ajahn Brahm talks about when he gives meditation retreats. The simile of sitting under the mango tree. All you have to do is sit under the mango tree and can wait for the fruit to drop in. The fruit dropping, hey, it's like if you're hungry, just wait for the mango to fall down. Oops, the mango comes down. Hopefully not here, but hopefully in front of you. You wait for the fruit to drop in. And this is a bit like this. All we have to do is just come back to these teachings. And one day, the mango will fall down all by itself. Wow, so delicious. Freedom, liberation, insight, understanding at last. It's almost hard to believe, isn't it? Can you believe it? Does anyone here believe this? Or do you think this is kind of really way over the top? So, of course, it takes the reason why it is hard is because it takes commitment. It takes perseverance. You really have to put this thing into practice. Yeah? You really have to come back to them. So the main thing that you need to do if you're going to have success in your spiritual life, maybe I should say this tomorrow, but not now, but anyway, I say it now anyway, is to come back to these teachings. Listen to good teachings. Inspire yourself. Move yourself forward on the path. If you ever feel let down, you feel things are getting a bit grey and dark, and you're feeling that you lost your inspiration or whatever, come back to these teachings again and again and again. Yeah, at least once a week, read something, listen to something to inspire you. Ideally, a little bit every day. Then you keep on going. Then, eventually, you're going to get somewhere. So this is how this works. And then you go through the whole thing, and eventually, avijja is eliminated, the ignorance is gone, the delusion is gone, and then all suffering is gone as well. This is what the Buddha is talking about here. So, that is the Sutta on avijja. And one of the things which is interesting, actually I can point this out as well because it's quite interesting, if you look at all of those factors we have just been covering, you will see that it is very similar to the Noble Eightfold Path. This may not be obvious because it may not be clear to you why that is the case, but if you look at these factors, you will see that we started out with the seven factors of awakening, that is the same as the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samma Samadhi, deep meditation, yeah? Then we have the Satipatthana, which is the same as the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samma Sati. Then we have the good conduct, and we have the sense restraint, and we have the situational awareness, and we also have the Yoniso Manasikara, and all that is part of right effort. Yeah, the effort to be pure, to purify your mind, all that comes of the right effort. Yeah? And then you have the you can actually, all of those factors, not just right effort, they're really also about all the morality factors as well, so also about right livelihood, right action and right speech. All of those are kind of here jumbled together, yeah? The three kinds of good conduct. Actually, that's actually a better way of looking at it. The three kinds of good conduct are all the right morality, and yeah, the same as morality of the Buddhist path, and then the yoniso manasikara, and maybe also the mindfulness and clear and situational awareness, is very similar to right intention on the Buddhist path. Yoniso manasikara means you are attending in the right way. Your intention is correct. Yeah? So very similar to that. And then it comes back to the very beginning. That is the faith, the listening to the good Dhamma, and the meeting of the hanging out with the Sangharisa, the superior people, is all about right view. Similar to right view on the Noble Eightfold Path. So actually, when you look at this, it is very closely related to the Noble Eightfold Path. This is one of the things that if you know how to read the suttas, you will see how everything is integrated. Everything is just different angles, different viewpoints of the same thing. And so this kind of opens your eyes up to a different way of looking at the path and the practice. And this is kind of the purpose of this. So, tomorrow we're going to have the last session then. And that is going to be more on how to put these things into practice, how to actually do this. Because this is the fourth of the four noble truths. So that is what's going to happen tomorrow. Yes, and that's it for now because it's already 4 o'clock. Then we'll see you back here again at 7 o'clock this evening again.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.